Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is photographer and artist Jan Kather. Kather received her MFA from Cornell University and currently teaches photography and video art at Elmira College in Elmira, New York. She is a founding member of the experimental artist group Rural Research Laboratories in Elmira and is a member of the state-of-the-art gallery in Ithaca, New York. She has done many collaborative projects, including installations, book and video projects, and photography exhibits. She is a recipient of several artist grants and has served as both a curator and co-curator for many projects around the region. And welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Tish.
It's so nice to see you. When you started out in the arts, did you start out just as a photographer and then segue into other...
Actually, my undergraduate work was in a general program for art educators at Edinburgh State College. So I didn't even start photography till I was about 26, I think.
Really?
And that was actually the medium that suddenly came alive for me. I didn't know if I really wanted to be a painter. I was never very good in sculpture. But that medium and the history of photography was very interesting to me. Women were accepted in photography in a way that I think they weren't recognized as much in painting and sculpture.
Yeah. Well, what kind of photography were you interested in the early days?
In the early days, I was really liking Alfred Stieglitz and what he did to bring fine art photography to the world.
Uh-huh.
So Paul Strand's work is still very much a favorite group of work that I like.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I liked the early photo secessionists. I don't know if you're familiar with that work, but they painted on their photographs.
Oh, yeah.
They made them out of focus. They scratched them so they'd look like etchings. And then Stieglitz said, you know, this is, you're just imitating painting. You have to do something that's closer to what the camera's capturing.
Ah.
So for a while, there was a change in photography. I came into photography in the 70s, and of course, that's the time where all of the rules were sort of thrown out. And again, people were painting and cutting things up and printing on cloth and just doing wilder kinds
of
things.
And also photography was going into different realms. You know, people were segueing from landscapes and pretty pictures to, you know, Diane Arbus is somebody that comes to my mind, who I absolutely loved.
Mm-hmm.
I love that exploration of the human psyche that she did. It was very interesting.
And seeing things that no one else had ever really seen. As she said, if I don't photograph this, people won't know this exists.
Yeah, so she gave us a new vision in many ways. Now, you were involved in photography with still dark rooms and SLRs and so on. Tell us about how that was compared to now with the digital.
Okay. Well, you had to really know how to operate a camera at that time. It was very common to underexpose film or overexpose film, so you had to learn about apertures and shutter speeds. That was the thing that I was really kind of afraid when I started photography, because I'm not that great in math, and I saw all those numbers. And then I suddenly understood it was about relationships, and that if you have a larger hole, more light comes in, you get a better exposure. So I figured that out. And once I got that technique down, it was just a matter of deciding how I wanted the picture to look, what was going to be in and out of focus, if I wanted to blur things because of using a long shutter speed.
Uh-huh.
Making all those choices were really exciting for me. Working in the darkroom itself, I would listen to music. It would be dark in there. You see a little bit with the safe lights, but it was just moments that you could really be on your own and think and listen to music. Enjoy yourself.
I remember the days too. Like I was telling you before we began, I was a photographer too, and I had a dark room. And it's a place to actually become a photographer in many ways.
It is.
And explore your own.
It's very hands on. It has a very distinct smell, as you know.
Sometimes
people come in and say, "Oh, it smells like vinegar in here."
But were you quick to adopt the digital, or did you resist?
I resisted a bit. My mentor at Cornell, one of them, I had Gene Losey and also Stan Bowman. Stan Bowman said to me, I ran into him one day in the John Hartel Gallery, he said, "You have to do Photoshop. You have to learn this." This was about 1995. So he invited me to sit in on a class that he was teaching, which was great. And I just learned a little bit of the basics from that. He always encouraged me to continue in digital, saying, you know, Jan, you can be in a dark room, but you need to know this. This is so fast. It's just a lot easier to do things this way. And I think as a person that works at Elmira College, I get calls from faculty. And this was about 2000, I got a call from the psych professor, Bob Cavalier. And he said, Jan, I need a portrait for my alumni magazine. I think it was at Columbia University. So I had just gotten this Nikon Coolpix. And I said, well, I'm going to come over and I'll take your picture and then I'll email it to you and see what you think. I did that. And I suddenly realized that a process that would have taken me all day, now I could do in less than an hour. I could actually walk across campus, take the picture, walk back, fix it up in Photoshop, send it to him for the okay, and send it on.
Yeah.
It really changed
it
working.
But does it make you not put as much thought into the work, though? Because, you know, photography, there has been argument about whether it's even art. Uh-huh. Susan Sontag started that whole dialogue. Mm-hmm. But has it made it less thoughtful?
I think it's just different, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So when the photography that I particularly like, that's the traditional photography with the silver prints, I like a straight photograph. And that includes, as you're talking about Diane Arbus, people who are maybe labeled more documentary photographers. I love that work, and I love it as a silver print. It has a physicality, a surface to it, that I feel like I've never been able to achieve in anything digital. On the other hand, aside from the speed that you can work, and as you're suggesting, maybe you get a bit superficial because everything's sort of easy once you know the technology of Photoshop and how to work with your computer. I liked the fact that I could start changing colors at will. I could make things look old, new, sharp, unfocused. You can do so much with Photoshop. I started doing a lot of collage with a digital collage, and I liked that. It's much harder to do that in the darkroom. So it pushed me more to do what I would call the manipulated image, an image that is never straight. Now, I do postings all the time of Facebook where I love like sunrises. I get up it's like the sky's been painted just for me. I do that like how people breathe. You know, I just kind of naturally do that. I don't think of that as being particularly expressive of anything other than how the awe I have at existence and living. So I do that, but it's not, as you're saying, I'm not really investing a whole lot.
Because I think about how much thought used to go into, when I was a photographer, into the composition.
Yes.
And you would have to really think about it.
Yes.
But now you can just manipulate it. You can just snap something and go, I can manipulate the composition with this little camera instead of with my mind.
Exactly. And I think the cropping and so forth, the idea that I think Cartier-Bresson was the one who tried to never crop, and I tell students to do that, because with a negative, if you don't crop, the quality of the image is much better because it starts to fall apart when you enlarge it. That's less of a problem in digital. So you're right. You had to really think about composition. You had a finite material you're working with. You had 36 pictures if you were using a SLR.
Yeah.
With digital, you know, I can go on and on and on for 16 gigabytes if I want to take...
Yeah, so the chances you'll get something good...
Or raise high a lot, in digital. Yeah.
Before you had to plan it out in some ways.
Right.
Now you've done a lot of collaborations with people. You've done photography for poetry books and so on. Tell us what attracted you to collaboration, because a lot of artists like to work alone.
Yeah, I started with Claire Reedy, and Claire had been a teacher of mine. She taught an art history classes I didn't think I was going to particularly like medieval art, and she made me love medieval art. So we became friendly, and she was writing an article for a publication of Elmira College called the Elmira Review, and she was looking at two of the buildings on campus. She wanted me to photograph them. So we went around, and as we talked, and she talked about the building, she talked about being a student at Elmira back in 1959.
Wow.
We had such a great conversation. When I read her essay, it made me see my own photographs in a new way. Like, she used quotes from Alfred Lord Tennyson, for instance.
Uh-huh.
So she was the kind of person who really put you in the period and connected that with where you were right now today. And we just hit it off. And after that, we started doing more work together, sometimes actually being in the same spot and responding and then coming together with our work. Other times, she would take my photos and she would write poems.
That's really interesting. So in some ways, collaborations have opened your mind as an artist.
Definitely. I believe that I know so much more because of all of the people I've ever worked with.
Wow,
multiplied.
That's amazing. I've never heard anybody say that, I don't think. Yeah. Huh. Now you belong to an experimental, and you're the founder of an experimental artist group called Rural Research Laboratories.
Yeah.
Tell us what that is.
Okay. Well, it started out, there were a few of us. Tom Oberg was the true founder, and Dan Alloy, some people in Ithaca will know Dan Alloy. He works at Cornell. We started the group, and eventually the Arnott Art Museum asked Tom to have this alternative space in the carriage house behind the museum. So once we had the space, we were able to incorporate more people. So there were Dan Reedy and Wendy Taylor were artists in town. We started organizing different exhibitions. Actually, Claire Reedy did several plays there. Colder Than Here was one of the plays she put together there. That was our first event, actually, was Colder Than
Here. Made this experimental? It was because you were experimenting with your own work, or is it experimental in that it was something new?
Well, I think it's experimental in Elmira for a group of people to get together, first of all, and decide that we were going to volunteer and just put all of this together. So I think in that sense it was experimental. Tom always was questioning everything I did. We had done other projects together. The one was the Barbie project. And when we worked on that, we had two different ideas about it. And mine came from my years in women's studies. And his came from an interest in looking at the drug situation in South America. So he was looking at these dolls that were floating on water. And he was seeing them as the people who carried drugs and then were killed after the drug was delivered. And I was looking at those dolls as being these floating poor representations of the female form that were very skinny and not what any of us really look like. And so I had a whole spiel about Barbie and how they desexualized this doll that every little girl had, but it had really it was only about fashion. So we always had this dialogue with each other. He would not like the things I did. Like one time I put these Barbie pictures together and I put glitter on them, and he said, "Jan, that's really awful." And I thought, of course, it was, you know, more experimental and it was really like Barbie. And so sometimes we'd have to collaborate and give in to each other because he didn't like some of the things I did. I started doing the lenticular prints, and that's where you have two separate images that you put on top of each other and there's a lens in front of it. And if you look one direction, you see one picture, and another direction, you see a different one. And he hated that. He said, "Oh, people are going to hate that." And I said, no, this is like Cracker Jacks. This is what Barbie is. It's so commercial." So we would work that out.
I would think experimental would give you the freedom to do what you want. Just that word.
It does. And I think he sometimes had trouble because he's conceptual. And the fun for him was the conceptual part, thinking something out. And he was less inclined to want to actually realize it, you know. So I think he liked me because I would be, "Well, we have to, you know, make objects now. And we have to, like, think about how that's going to be installed and how are we going to light this."
So you got to have a tug of war with him. And you probably learned a lot. Both of you probably
actually
did.
He introduced me to iMovie. He came in one day to my office and he said, "You know, you have software, you can make movies." And that was the first person, and that was about 2005 when I started video.
Well, you know what, that's what I wanted to actually segue into. I want to talk about video art. It's a medium that I've often misunderstood, perhaps, but I don't quite get where it goes from just video to really art.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yes. And I think that's a really good question. And I think many people will give you a different answer to that. The earliest video artists were trying to go against what your expectations. We have been weaned on TV, so we all think we know what video is.
Mm-hmm.
So those early artists, you know, were turning the TV sideways. You know, they were just doing all the things that you're not supposed to do to make you aware that you have been sort of hypnotized in a way by the media. It may have certain expectations of what you're going to see. So I think a lot of early video artists were disrupting our expectations. I think the role of contemporary artists often is that there's an understanding that we know what a painting is. It has a frame around it. So if you're an artist who starts doing paintings and you tack it up against the wall, suddenly all those people who think they know have to go in and question that and question why they think a painting is more valuable if it's, you know, in a very expensive frame, for instance. I think video is the same way.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jan Cather. She's a artist and photographer, and we're talking about video art and what makes it art instead of just video. To continue on this is interesting to me.
Well,
So you think it's just disrupting people's expectations about what video is or what paintings are?
Yes, I think that's where it separates traditional video and our expectations of turning on the TV and seeing something that has a plot. Often video art does not have a plot. You will be looking at imagery, motion, sound, sometimes in synchronization, in the same spirit that you look at an abstract painting. I'm very interested in abstraction in video. I've actually collaborated with one of my gallery mates at State of the Art, Jim Spitznagel and Trevor Pinch. They're in a group called the Electric Golem, and they asked me to do some video for them. And so we've worked together, and we keep saying we're going to work together again. But it's a way that you can see how sound maybe evoke shape, and that the tempo of the music has to match the movement for it to feel like it synchronizes. On the other hand, you might have a video artist that pulls in a sound audio track that has nothing to do with what the images are. So then you have to, we as human beings want to make sense of things. Mm-hmm. So we're challenged, and we make some message out of those things. And I think it's always an open interpretation. So I think it's good that you are a little bit puzzled, because if it were so easy for you to say, oh, I know exactly what video art is about, I think you're looking at it superficially.
Yeah,
I
that's true.
It's trying to prod you to think of the world. And today, we record all the time, you know. We're walking down the city street.
Yeah,
and
to the point where we don't really live anymore. Many people are so caught up in this high-tech world that they're ignoring their communities.
Right.
That's the part that really bothers me about it.
It is problematic, I think.
Yeah. I want to talk about an international project you've been part of, the Exquisite Corpse Video Project. I love that title, obviously.
Yeah.
It's absolutely poetic. Tell us about it.
Well, that started, I was part of a group that met online with Art Review, which is an artist's website that comes out of Britain, and it's changed now. It's called For Art. But anyway, we all met online. None of us knew each other. The person who started the project was Kika Nicolella in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And I was started into the second group. The first six videos, actually, I screened some in Elmira. Later that summer, we screened it in Monkey Town in Brooklyn. But what it incorporated, you're probably familiar with the Exquisite Corpse poetry that the surrealists
from the 20s
dealt with, where you take one piece and you give it to the next artist, and they don't really understand what the piece exactly was ahead of them. So what we did is we made 30 seconds of video, and the last 10 seconds we sent to a designated person. They had to make a video using our 10 seconds. But we didn't know what they did with it, and then their last 10 seconds went to a next person. So until we had the screening, we never knew really what this was going to look like.
That's a fascinating idea for video.
And it was all over the world, because today you can send by the internet these video files. So the people I worked with, Michael Shang was in Denmark, is one of the people, and Marty McCutcheon was in Berkeley, California. So they were two people who became really good friends of mine, and I've actually met Michael Shang. Has come twice from Copenhagen to visit me, and Marty has come from Berkeley with his family.
That's good. So what did it find out? What did it end up being? Just fragments, or did it become a real whole?
Sometimes I felt there was a real story that happened, and it would be totally by accident. You've probably looked at some of my other projects. I worked with aleatoric video, so I'm very interested. Aleatoric means that things come about by chance. So by chance, there would sometimes be these narratives. So in the seventh video that I did, I had gotten footage from Michael in Copenhagen. I did footage, and then I sent it to Niklas Hallberg in Sweden. And I've cut that into a small piece and sometimes exhibited just the three of us, because I thought it told a love story. Michael's piece was a man who was on the street playing an instrument, and he had money that he was collecting in a cup, and he was very poor. And mine, and I, of course, I don't know this, because I only had the last 10 seconds, and I actually thought this guy was on a typewriter, and he was doing an accordion. But anyway, mine, I asked a Japanese student to play his piano, and I wanted him to write in Japanese, like a Dear Jane letter, that my art is more important important. And then, of course, I don't know about the accordion at this point. I thought Michael's stuff was about a typewriter. But I wanted to use keys, and I got his hands playing the piano. But I also got him writing in Japanese to this woman, this imaginary woman, I love you, and because I love you, I can't be with you because my creating art is more important and you'll be neglected. Okay, so I had that.
Wow.
My little piece I sent to Nicholas, and he had his partner, Stina Paris' daughter, is lying on this piano like from a 1930s movie with these long gloves and this evening gown, and she's lying on the piano stroking her fingers across the piano keys looking forlorn. So I thought it really told the story of if you give up your love for your art, you're going to end up being alone on the street collecting money. So that was just
so it did turn into a story. That's really
fascinating. Yeah, and they didn't always, but that I thought did, and it's just by chance. And I can make up the story. That's the beauty of this, because everybody who looks at those videos comes out with a different interpretation.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. Now let's talk about you have an exhibit in Berkeley, California this month.
Yes.
That's going to be going on. Tell us what it is.
Okay, so that's again, Marty McCutcheon, and he lives in Berkeley. He has a studio on Shattuck Avenue.
Hmm.
He has started an internet group, the Round Table Collaboration. So I've done a lot of projects with that group as well. The latest one is, there are two that are on exhibit right now. One is called the Postal Collage Project 2, and the other one is called Bodybuilding. So the Postal Collage is where we actually physically work on cut paper, paste, whatever you want to do, and send it through the mail to another person. So I've sent work to people in Denmark and Netherlands. Sometimes I send to Marty in California. They're all over the world, these people. You have to agree that you'll spend the money to do the postage. Sometimes some interesting things happen.
So what happens to it, though? You send it to somebody else and it turns
into
a whole
piece? And they add on
to
it. And it comes back to you as the person who initiated it. And you do the final touches to it before you then send it to Marty. And so that's what's the piece that I initiated is in Berkeley with my final touches, though I'm part of all these other ones, and I can look at them and usually see something of myself. The other thing, Tish, I should say about this, I am so humbled by working with people all over the world because they know English, and I don't know Danish, I don't know French, I don't know Spanish, Italian, I know a little Italian, but, you know, I am very humbled by this, and really love the fact that that they want to speak with me in English, and they want to reach out and communicate.
Yeah,
it's
well, that's what art's about. I mean, that's the epitome of what art should be, right? Communication.
That's what I think.
And opening people's eyes and bringing in new ideas and visions and of the way we live.
Let me just say that the last piece was the bodybuilding, and I think I sent you a picture. And this time, for the first time, I worked with three women. So I think ours came out a little bit differently. We kind of discussed it online. And these women I have not met. One is Cora DeLange from Argentina. The other two are British, Nikki Hare and Ellen McGoslin. We feel like that we're working in mythology. And I like Carl Jung and the idea of the cosmic consciousness. We all sort of looked at Mother Earth figures. Our figures, there were some men in our collages, but they were mostly coming out of female figures and animals.
That's,
and combining animals and women and looking really powerful, I think. Maybe a little ferocious sometimes.
Exactly. That photo that you sent me, they do. And they look almost grotesque in their emotions, whatever you take from the emotions.
Forbidding if you came up to them, right?
Maybe. I might want to join them.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. Let's talk about the fact that you teach photography and video arts at Elmira College. Tell us, how do you teach photography these days?
Well, I still have a dark room, and so students who are taking the photography class will go into the dark room, and they'll learn how to operate the camera, learn about aperture, shutter speeds, how that affects your picture. They put together a final portfolio. They love that because it's such a communal activity. You go into the dark room. We have a gang dark room, so they're all in there working and talking, and they get to know each other really well. That really happens less in my video art class, because we're in with the computers, and you're facing more your own equipment. You're not talking to each other as much. Lately, I have been doing some more, urging them to collaborate a little bit so that they can act for each other, or they can, if you need someone to film something, you can ask each other. So they're starting to work a little more in the way you would suspect if you're in filming anything. You need help. I tell people if they want to learn digital photography, just to take my video class, because I go over Photoshop. A lot of things that you do in animation will come out of Photoshop. So I sort of separate it that way. The people who really want to learn photography are in my darkroom class.
And you still think it's important, even in this digital age, for people to learn the original techniques?
Well, I'm going to say yes, it's important. I think it's also negligible if that's not the goal that a person wants to achieve. So if I have students who say they like that limit of 36 pictures. They have to make them count. They have to pay attention to exposure. They wait for a certain time of day to photograph. It's much more precious for them, and it's more meaningful to them.
Yeah.
They're touching the prints. There's a physicality. There's that smell in the dark room.
And watching the picture appear,
it's magic.
It's magic. Yes, it is.
Absolutely. And they all love that, all the students I have. Now, it's harder and harder for them to get cameras. So I have 4 loaner cameras now. So if they're in the class, sometimes they have to share a camera. I tell them, ask your grandpa, your uncle, your aunt, somebody may have a camera. They're really happy to give you.
And I still have an old Pentax.
Yeah, people usually are family members will definitely give.
Yeah, and I'm hanging on to mine.
Yeah, no, I think you should.
I want us to go back to that in some ways. Do you go beyond teaching technique and so on to seeing actually people becoming creative after they've learned to use the tools?
Yes, that's the excitement, I think, of teaching, is to kind of equip students with the skills, but then they come back with different visions, and what they bring back is always exciting. I had a student, Desiree Caballero and Rene Bianchi, who both, they collaborated, and they photographed down at the bus station at Elmira, and that became a project that was funded by a grant. Their photographs are still hanging down at the bus station through the month of June. But just to see them be able to go up to strangers, not that I saw them, but I saw the results. They have some amazing human portraits of people who ride those buses. And they were asked to try to get the variety of people that they could. They had to fight that because a lot of people don't want to be photographed, and they wouldn't give information. Even if they would photograph, they said, no, I don't want to give my home address. So they had to fight a little bit of problem that they hadn't anticipated. But the end product was really an amazing piece of a body of work. And I think of Diane Arbus, actually, in some of the ways they had very confrontational, direct kind of pictures.
Oh, that's great. It's so nice to see that creativity. Once you give people tools, I think most people can find some creativity. Well, we are almost out of time. Can you talk to us about any new works that you might be producing that we may see sometime, like at the State of the Art?
Well, there'll be a member show in November, and I'm putting together some work where I'm combining photographs I've done of the moon, the craters of the moon, with some things that I've just found around in my walks. So I'm not going to tell you too much about it, but it's that thing I do with Photoshop where I combine several images to create a whole new reality, which usually suggests the cosmos some way. Give you that clue. I'm always interested in the environment. I've been interested also lately in forgiveness, and so I'm trying to figure out what I want to do with that. I feel like people are really kind of mean these days and are holding grudges, and I would like to address that through my art. So that may be coming.
That's great. Oh, we need that. We absolutely need that. Jan Cather, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure talking to you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.